Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill them all up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff
McClure. We are here to talk to you today about things financial, the economy, whether or not inflation exists, and other things that you should probably already know, or maybe don't.
It only exists in our mind.
Only in our mind. Anyway, this is The Personal Wealth Coach, and we are not just a radio program. We're also required to say that we, the two principals in a SEC-registered investment advisory firm, are the co-hosts. Why are we supposed to tell you that? Well, because the SEC needs you to know that if we say something, we're going to say some stupid stuff. Some illegal stuff on the air about how the market works or things like that, you should tell the SEC, which is a very clear statement that they don't approve us in any way except that we register through them.
Oh, that was a good segue. I like that.
And just because we're registered with them to offer investment advice doesn't mean we can do that on the air, because that'd be one of those things you could complain about, because there's no privacy on the air. And investment advice is supposed to be tailored specifically to the person's given to, not given broadly. So what are we doing? Oh, we're just jabbering. We're just talking words, nothing advisory at all. It's educational.
That makes the unwarranted assumption that we know what we're doing.
Oh, yes. Who would warrant that? Which leads us to the next warranty guarantees statement, which is...
The information we present on this informational educational radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information. Beep.
Very nicely done. Right. Was that a recording?
Yes.
That was a recording.
It was in my brain. It was a recording in my brain.
It's a recording now because we record the episodes, but...
Oh. So is it episodic?
It is episodic in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, welcome to the Personal Wealth Coach. And we generally start off by talking about the small marks.
The Marquette.
Yes. And the Marquette that people seem to be most interested in is the stock Marquette. And we can report that the price of beef is leveling off.
Not livestock.
Oh, common stock. The other stock market.
Stocks, yes.
Common stock. Well, I don't know. Steers are pretty common.
I would say they're more common here than in other places.
Right.
Yeah.
The S&P 500 stock index, which is the one we prefer to follow, even though it has its foibles. That's my word for the day, is foibles. It did almost nothing for the week. Well, I did a lot of ups and downs, but at the end of the week, it was up 36/100 of 1% to 4145.19, which is delightful. Why is it delightful? Well, we're going to talk about the jobs report and things that came out during the week that would indicate that the typically in earlier weeks, earlier months, would have caused the S&P 500 to descend, but it didn't, which is really pleasant. Actually went up on Friday, and Friday is a very notable day in the market week. It's now over 13% higher than it was in mid-June. It's still down 13.5% from its high in early January. In other words, it's up as much as it was down. How do you like that? Actually, it's not because of the way statistics are figured, but it looks
right.
Cool.
Percentages don't quite work that way.
It sounds cool.
If you go down 50%, you have to go up 100% to get back to where you were. So,
but it didn't go down 50%. It only went down just over 20%.
Right. So, it has to go up more than that.
Well, it's down 6.57% from last year. If you are an investor in stocks, mutual funds, things, equities, that should not actually bother you very much. What's important is to look back a minimum of 3 years, preferably longer. The S&P 500 is up 41.5% from 3 years ago, which is just before the pandemic, which is like a 12.5% rate of return over the period. Whoa, that's cool. we follow another index, the CRS. By the way, that rate of return we've seen over the last 3 years is much higher than the long-term rate of return of the S&P 500. If you stretch it out and you get into true long-term returns, you get into 7-8% range, which is these are price returns, by the way. They do not include dividends. So we are actually in an interruption in a bull market.
It's a hiccup.
This thing that is occurring right now, like the thing that occurred in 2020, if you look at it long term, we are in, by any definition, a secular bull market.
Right.
Now, there's cyclical bull markets and there's secular bull markets, which is why I was talking about livestock a little earlier, because there are secular bulls and there's cyclical bulls, and then there's the steers.
Yeah, which don't act as bulls at all.
No, but they can. Anyway. Yes. So what we're in clearly is a secular bull market, and a secular bull market runs for sometimes decades, and we are in one that's running for decades. Why do I know that? I mean, I could go into a lot of detail on it, but suffice to say that when you look back 3 years and you see a much higher rate of return than the really long-term rate of return of the S&P 500, this is an indication that the growth is overcoming non-growth. It's overcoming contraction. Expansion is overcoming contraction pretty dramatically. And one of the things that happens in a secular bull market is the more bullish it is, the greater the variance will be along the way. That it seems to be an immutable law of nature, not just in markets, but in everything else. And if you don't believe it, try driving a pickup across a pasture. The faster you drive, the bumpier it gets. And Basically, the faster the economy grows and corporations grow in the United States, the bumpier the ride will be and the bigger the bumps will be. We are going through right now a bump in a secular bull market. Now, that's hard for people to get their minds around when they're looking at the fact that we're theoretically still in a bear market. But we tend to have very short-term time horizons as humans. If you're going to be a successful investor, and we've been watching a lot of successful investors and reading about them from the years before, over the last 50 years, I've been watching them, and basically they have long time horizons. And if your time horizon is longer, you tend to do better.
Are you wrapped up on the markets? Because this is amazing segue into a lot of the questions that we have waiting.
Yeah, we get into
a
lot of other things. Okay, the CRSP.
There we go.
Is up 9.8% from its bottom in June, and there are people in the media, pessimists, who are saying this is just a bear market rally. It isn't. The bottom wasn't back in June. The real bottom is yet to come. I don't know. This is why we say buy and hold.
Yeah.
You really can't tell when a bear market is over until you look back.
Hindsight's 20/20. It's easy to look back and see it, but that's the deal, is if you don't buy and hold, you miss out on the rise. If you still think there's another bottom coming and there isn't, you missed out on it. If you got out at the bottom because you think there's more down, you lost money there. But long term, if you just had a really well-diversified portfolio and held through it, you did great.
And when we look at the studies, and I've read a lot of studies on this, the best performing investors over time are buy and hold investors. You would think of the people who get out at the top and get in at the bottom, those are the people who would have the best returns. Well, there's a whole series of hedge funds called the Tiger Funds and the Tiger Cubs that are, like I said, crying in their beer right now. Because they said, oh, this is a terrible bear market coming, we're getting out. So they got out, and they're really happy about the fact that they got out. And the market is now higher than when they got out, and they're still not back in, and they're sweating. And they're probably the ones who are saying in the media, oh, this is going to be a far worse bear market, you need to get out now, because they want the market to come back down so they can get back in. Better just to be well-diversified, have good cash reserves, and ride through something like this. The 10-year U.S. Treasury yield zipped up 7% to 2.843% with the 2-year, but we still have a negative yield curve. We have an inverted yield curve because the 2-year note is at 3.226.
Why is that important?
There is an inversion.
Yeah, why is that important?
Historically, when we've had an inversion in the yield curve, it indicates that there's about a 70 or 80% probability that there will be a recession within the next 18 months. However, did you see the little semicolon in there? And then just before however, and then a comma after however.
We got to have a little asterisk. This is even better. Put an asterisk there, and then down at the bottom of the radio page, write in very small print this whole next paragraph you're about to say.
Okay. There is growing evidence that this inversion of the yield curve may not be real. So it's not a real yield inversion. It's an unreal yield inversion. And why? The argument that I have read...
And we'll have the opposite side of this as well in just a moment.
Okay. So, yeah. Is that the Federal Reserve is, I use the term unwinding its balance sheet to mix metaphors. They're allowing securities to mature without buying new ones, which is the effect that, which has a similar effect to selling securities on the market. When you sell securities on a market, or sell anything, a lot of like $30 billion a month, which is what they're doing, it causes the prices for that particular set of securities to go down, which causes their interest rate to go up, their yield to go up. It is in the middle of that bulge, starting at about the 18-month point and going out to about 5 years, where the Federal Reserve is unloading interest-bearing securities on the market and thereby artificially raising the rates in the market, which is what they're trying to do, which would suggest the Fed has never done this way before. It would indicate that the market, the bond market, is not saying we're going to have a recession. The Fed is distorting the market, possibly with a dual effect. One, they do want to lessen their balance sheet. They want to shrink it. But the other one is they may want to give the impression a recession is coming to stop people from spending so much money, so that inflation will come down, and we won't know until the historians look at the secret Fed notes and figure out what's going on. And you want to tell you the other side of the story.
Yeah, the other side of it is, let's get real basic. Real basic.
Real basic.
Why does an inverted yield curve make a recession? Wait a minute. That isn't basic in any way, shape, or form, is it? If you're a business owner, and you want to expand your business, you're making a profit, you're building up your reserves, you don't want to spend your reserves to expand, but your profit's coming in quickly. So you think, I can afford a loan to further expand. The profits from the expansion should easily pay for the loan. So you go out and you get the loan and you expand your business. That calculation changes with interest rates. If you say profits are coming in, but with the interest rate as high as it is right there in the midsection, that's when I want to borrow, because I don't want a really 30-year loan to expand my business over the next 5 years. I want a 5-year loan to do that, or an 8-year loan to do that. Not that they give very many 8-year loans out there, but you follow what I'm saying. And if those interest rates are going up, it's going to slow business expansion. That's like the key area that businesses are going to be borrowing in to expand. So whether or not, let's put some air quotes around this, this is a real or unreal inverted yield curve, the market, part of the market is the Fed. They bought a bunch of stuff on the market, and now they're selling a bunch of stuff on the market. Just like any other large purchaser, only they're quintillion times larger than the other large purchasers. They affect the market with their buys and their sells. You can just see it more. It still makes it more expensive to expand a business. Now, having said that, capital expenditures are up. Business, they are expanding right now. They're spending money on expansion, and it's at a pretty good rate, near record. So how can that be true? Well, because they're expanding with money that they already borrowed or reserves that they had on hand already. So this is why an inverted yield curve is really predicting out 18 months, is if this inversion maintains, it means that capital expenditure is going to be slowing over the next 18 months or so because it's more expensive to do it, and that could cause a recession. Now, we haven't had a recession for every inverted yield curve, but we've had no recessions that didn't have an inverted yield curve. So what you said is this might be a trick from the Federal Reserve to make us feel like we're going into a recession so we stop spending so much, which just is a mild slowdown, but it fights the inflation. But at the same time, it looks like Congress is about to pass a bill that is going to spend a lot of money to fight inflation, which just that there's a little problem with you don't spend money to fight inflation. Wait, sorry, that's not how it works. So the Fed's got another kind of weird unknown on the radar. So that's two sides of this. We don't know is the answer to this, and it really should be the answer all the time. We think based on history that we're not going to have a recession based on what we know in the next 6 months, but we might have one next year. And why is it you never get an economist that's going to say 100% we're going to have a recession, or if you do, they're not very reliable because they call it the same way every time? It's because nobody knows everything. It's like a doctor is not going to tell you, you have exactly 3 days to live, because that's an unknown. So we're looking at the health of the economy, and there are definitely some friction points that are going to limit our growth in the future at the very least, and possibly create a recession, maybe, but probably not right away.
Well, one of the issues, you're talking about loan rates, SBA, the current SBA loan rates for the typical one, the SBA 7A fixed rate loan, is generally around 10% right now.
Right.
And when you consider that we're looking at inflation as high as it is, that's still a pretty dirt cheap loan.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
it's still expansionary. It's worth, this is something we've talked about.
We're still in an expansionary economy.
This isn't neutral yet. Even though we're raising interest rates, and the Federal Reserve's raising interest rates, the rest of us are too, because of the way we're acting. We kind of follow the Fed in this stuff. People are selling into the market, and that's part of the reason why interest rates are going up. So this concept is that we're following them along, and it makes sense that this could be another tool in their toolbox. It could very clearly be them saying, hey, we're slowing down and this might be a recession. We're selling in this interest rate, this maturity range. They have other stuff. They've got a lot of 30-year stuff, but they're selling in a clump right now to do something a little different than normal. I know this is really back CSI stuff behind the scenes. What's going on back here? It looks like the Federal Reserve is trying to touch our confidence to say, hey, stop spending so fast. Things might be worse in the future. And if that's the case, it's kind of cool because it may actually prevent us from having a real recession. But it only works a couple of times, because if they keep flagging, hey, we might have a recession and then we don't have it, people aren't going to look at the inverted yield curve as a problem anymore. So, yeah, there's even more complicated. That's as basic as we can get on it. Sorry.
Well, to finish off on markets, WTI, West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil, dropped 10.36% during the week to 88.37. Yes, I said 88.37. It was $130 a barrel a few weeks ago. Whoa. And if you think I am on hallucinatory drugs or was looking at a different year or something, go look at the gas pump and you will discover that at gas stations, the prices are coming down. Why is the big question? Because there's another figure that goes in here. Our trade deficit dropped. Our exports went up and our imports went down. Well, the reason the exports went up is we're selling a lot of fuel. We're selling gas and gasoline overseas, but the price is coming down here. Well, we talked about earlier, one of the reasons the price of gasoline went up is there were a bunch of refineries shut down for maintenance and stuff like that, and they got caught by surprise because you don't just start them up and shut them down. The high price of gasoline in a free market system did what it normally does, and it caused the oil companies to say, we got to figure a way to produce more gasoline so we can make more money, which is not a bad thing in a capitalist system. And they did it. And so now there's more gasoline out there, which, and people have decided to not drive quite as much. And right, between the two of them, the price of gasoline is coming down to something reasonably normal, which follows on to the next thing, if you can excuse my segue. The primary driver in inflation so far this year has been fuel costs. And if fuel costs are coming down, over the next 2 months, I suspect you will see significantly lower inflation numbers. I don't know what they'll be year over year, but because that's looking back a full year. But month to month, they're undoubtedly coming down at this point, which this is where my optimism jumps in. If inflation numbers start coming down, the Fed then has room to not raise interest rates so much, which lowers the probability that we will eventually slide into a recession.
That's a lot of stuff.
Chain of stuff. It's a chain of stuff now.
And that it very
completely wrong.
And are we done with the markets? Because this all fits very nicely into. We have a question from Inquisitor John. Thank you, John, very much. Your monetary cycle question.
Yes, and you can give us more questions at either jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com, preferably both.
Yes. John's got a question about the monetary cycle. And he's, as is tradition, he has a picture of the Wall Street Journal, a phone digital picture of the paper Wall Street Journal, which has been circled and underlined in specific areas. And his question is, what will the second half of the cycle look like? It's from the article, An Inflated Sense of Success, and it's kind of a book review on Ben Bernanke's 21st century monetary policy. And there's a section of it where he says, inflation and the Fed's belated scramble to raise rates and scale back on quantitative easing have revealed that we are still only in the middle of a monetary cycle that began around 2007 or 8 during the panic. What is a monetary cycle? Well, a monetary cycle is the interest rate lowering and rising in the market. So what is the cost of money, basically? If you want to go borrow something, what does it cost you to borrow it? And if you think about this in a really big picture setting, 1980s, the early 1980s, we had extreme double-digit interest rates. 24% on a mortgage. Yes, that was real. That was a real mortgage and somebody that had decent credit. It was very, very short. It was a very short period that it was that high, but it existed. And then we came all the way down to 2.5% being decent credit just a few months ago. About a year ago, you could have gotten a loan at 2.5%. There's a lot of difference between 24% and 2.5%. So that's a longer term loan cycle where we expect interest rates to be rising now. Well, on the monetary policy side, on the money, what it costs you just to spend money, what's the inflation rate look like? How are we fighting it? That cycle has other things that cause it to shift. The panic of 2007 and 8 was a lot of people not paying their loans back. That makes money just get destroyed. And that's a literal term. It is destroyed. No money exists where there was money. A bank had on a balance sheet a loan that they had to erase. That's how we keep money. It's mostly on electronic balance sheets. When you erase it, it's a real thing. Money was being destroyed, and the Federal Reserve stepped in and printed a bunch of money, not at the mint, not the paper stuff, but by giving out loans and paying interest on deposits in reverse. So you could get a loan from the Federal Reserve and deposit it and make a profit on the round trip if you were a bank. They were literally giving money to banks so that the banks could replace the money they lost. Now, they did a lot of other stuff, too. They bought bonds on the open market, both mortgage-backed securities, so mortgages, but mortgages that have been repackaged in big mixed groups so that it's not just your mortgage, it's about 10,000 mortgages all mixed together in a stew pot with nothing else added. So it's not really a good stew. It's just one ingredient. But you know what I'm saying. So this package is sitting out there. That's being purchased by the Federal Reserve back at the panic time period. Why? Well, because banks were locked up. They didn't have any cash on hand. They had a bunch of mortgages, but they didn't know what the mortgages were worth. So they couldn't make any loans. That was the freeze. Well, the Federal Reserve stepped in and started buying those things and actually literally putting money in the pockets of the banks. Wait, that's not literal. Banks don't have pockets. You get what I'm saying. The banks then have a bunch of money that they can loan out, and they don't have to charge very much interest rate on it because they're getting money hand over fist from the Fed. So they've got some reserve requirements so they don't go under. They got to hold cash on hand. but there's enough cash and it's kind of building. The Federal Reserve dumped in 1 month, it dumped $500 billion into the mortgage-backed securities market during the crisis. Just here you go, guys. We're buying all these things from you banks. And the banks suddenly had $500 billion in their on their balance sheets that was money and not a long-term vehicle. So they could loan it or they could invest it again. Now, over time since then, interest rates have started up and then come back down as we had a little threat of a slowdown here or there. But we've been in a very easy part of what would be considered a long-term cycle. It's been very easy to get loans. Interest rates have been very low, and that's caused the housing market prices to come way up because they're less expensive with a low interest rate loan. Well, now we're entering the next part of that cycle. And this is the question, what's the second half of the cycle look like? It's a tightening cycle where interest rates go up for quite a good time, making it more expensive to gather money. How long will that last? That's a good question. We've nobody knows that answer. The short-term monetary cycles go anywhere from 4 years to 20 years long. So this is a pretty normal cycle. We're kind of right in the middle of that. Where's some four-year ones? In the early 90s, we had a series of cycles where interest rates came down and then went up and then came down and then went up. It was really easy to see the cycles there. And it caused the market to act a little bit goofy. When we have these longer, more pronounced cycles, or less pronounced cycles, where the Federal Reserve is giving us a real clue on what they're about to do regularly, it does tend to calm the markets, which is one of the jobs of the Federal Reserve. So this is a weird, they got given a job of helping to calm the markets right after the Great Recession. So we don't know what that looks like. And it kind of looks like what we've been talking about most of this hour, of they're using a different kind of tool to say, hey, what happens if we invert the interest rates rather than you guys and slow your spending down a little bit, and then we can uninvert it too. So it looks different this time than usual. They've got some other tools and some other responsibilities that they didn't have in the last interest rate, the last monetary cycle. From my perspective, it's fascinating. From most people's perspective, it's very boring. Do you have something to add to that?
I think you covered it very well.
It's very, very thickly covered. I'm glad I'm wearing my boots.
And I think one of the things that he mentioned in the question with, by the way, as you said, the article is a book review. We're in some long-term cycles. I mentioned earlier that we are in a secular bull market. In looking at the world, there are some very long-term cycles underway, and some of them are pretty scary and some of them are pretty benign. One of the things I think is really important to keep our eye on at this point, and we mentioned this in the newsletter, Europe is sliding into recession. Goldman Sachs, which generally is got a pretty good handle on this, says that it's already in recession. By the way, any of you who think that somehow the stimulus acts, the three stimulus acts, and of course, if you're a Republican, you're blaming the Democrats, and if you're a Democrat, you're blaming the Republicans, somehow caused the inflation that we're having here. There were no stimulus acts in Great Britain, and the Bank of England is warning that inflation will hit 13% in the near future. It's already higher than it is here. The official July inflation rate in the Eurozone was 8.9%, which is basically the same level of inflation we're having. And believe me, our stimulus bills did not affect the European economy. If you want somebody to blame for inflation, it isn't Joe Biden or Donald Trump or Congress or anything else. It's Vladimir Putin. That's important to recognize. It's important to recognize that they're slipping into recession in Europe with high inflation. In the United States, we have had high inflation. Remember that when you see the consumer price index, it's looking back a full year. It's a lagging indicator. The evidence that we're seeing indicates that inflation is leveling off. I think by next year, probably inflation will no longer be a big threat on our horizon. I think that the Fed will back off. I think probably if we have a recession, it'll be extremely minor. What does that say to you as an investor or whatever it is that you are, if you're listening? It means just hang in there. It ain't that bad. You sell ads in newspapers and things like that by proclaiming the world's coming to an end. It ain't. There are some things to worry about, and it has nothing to do with things we've been talking about so far.
Yeah. So when we're talking about what causes inflation to come back to reality, this is another segue. Last week, we did a best of program, though. How do you do the best of a mud puddle? But we did. We did a best
don't
of
stir up the mud.
Yeah, we keep it as clear and translucent as possible for a mud puddle. But we had a question then that fits very nicely into this from Inquisitor John again, and we've got another question from him for this week as well. So I want to hit this. His question is about: do we have an upcoming glut in chips? The article in question, China makes big bets on basic chips. They're making a bunch of plants. There's 31 major semiconductor plants China's got under construction right now. There's 19 happening in Taiwan and 12 in the United States. Just as a side note, if you want to do some math here, that means that the Chinese on the mainland are making 31 semiconductor plants, and the Americans and the Taiwanese together are making 31 semiconductor plants. It's an interesting number, and it's probably not coincidental on the Chinese side. So whether or not they're doing it as well as the rest of the world is a question, but they are keeping up. Okay, so what is it? How is this a segue from inflation? There's a lot of money being spent right now. We were talking about capital expenditures. A lot of money being spent fixing supply chains. And by fixing them, a lot of times that means scrapping them and restarting them and making them better from that end. And that takes a while. One of those is the fact that we've got so many chip plants coming online in the United States. This is where we actually use them. Supply chain issues get a lot shorter when the chip is next door than when the chip is on the other side of the planet. It's a kind of a nice statement there. So our supply chains are getting better. That's one of the major issues in inflation this time around. It isn't so much the monetary supply, although we've got a lot of it. It's the fact that we've had such a weird demand supply shift based on the pandemic, and then some more pandemic, and then more pandemic, and then a war in Ukraine. So all of this has made our supply chains all weird. And we're investing a bunch of money to be able to make the things that are the most expensive things right now cheaper, because those are the things people want to sell the most. It's kind of cool. Hey, these are the most expensive. Let's sell those. Let's make more of them. Well, that causes the price to come down. And this is part of a cycle as well. So when we look at our inflationary tendencies right now, as you just said, we're probably already at or just behind the peak in the inflation in the United States. Because I'm seeing a lot of stuff hitting the market. I'm seeing a lot of inventory rise. And this question is an upcoming glut in chips. Absolutely. This is one of the amazing things about innovation is that the cheaper things are, the more likely you are to use them. There's this big heat wave going on in Europe. Man, it sounds like I just changed the subject, doesn't it? They don't have air conditioning in most of Germany. They just don't have it. So why? When you ask a German, they say, well, that's very expensive. And that makes sense. Energy prices are up as well. But they don't have it. And here we have it. And we kind of use it all the time in the places that we need it. It's just an accepted part. Yes, and it's expensive, but the prices come way down because so many of us are using it. And when you have enough of a demand, people find a way to sell you the thing that you want. And a lot of people start to compete for that niche eventually. That causes prices to come down. When you have 62 major chip manufacturers coming online in the next 2 years. That's massive. That is a, such a major leap ahead in the number of major semiconductor plants that there's no point in history that we've seen that kind of increase in supply. What's that going to do to prices? This is rocket surgery, I understand, but we can do it. You use the scalpel on the red wire. Supply goes up, demand stays constant, then price goes down. But demand's going up too. Everything's getting chips in it. Well, I think demand's going up slower than this massive leap in supply. So we're going to see some price alleviation there. I just like to say alleviation sometimes. Because
the word that I saw used was disinflationary.
Yes, but
I like that word.
They're just dissing it.
It is so complicated, it really doesn't mean anything, but it does mean that we need to break for commercials.
Yeah, when you get a tire puncture, that's disinflationary. It's
disinflationary,
too.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
And we could go into a long discussion on the inflation in tire prices while you're inflating your tires. But in the meantime, we do have to play some commercials. If you would like to join in conversation with us, the email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or The Personal Wealth Coach. And we will be back on the other side of these very important announcements. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jake and
Jeff
McClure. Yeah, we're back. Now we have some other questions, but did you have something you wanted to say in between?
Well, this hour and next hour, I want to talk about a bigger picture and a longer term view of the world. But we can deal with the questions right now.
Okay. And we got another question that popped in while we were out there from Roger. We've got another question from John, but we'll hit, and this was about the TSP, the Thrift Savings Plan for federal employees. It's kind of, in a very loose way, their version of a 401k. But before we get to that one, Roger just sent us a question, and it says, the subject line is new law to promote domestic chip manufacture. In the past, you mentioned that federal subsidy of solar panels stifled innovation in that product. While I doubt the new law to increase domestic chip production is promoting a particular chip, is it possible it will end up subsidizing obsolete technology? Yes, it is possible. It is designed a little bit smarter than some of the other subsidy bills, because it's based on strategic value rather than on the idea of climate impact. Strategic value tends to have a much more clearly defined goal. Hey, we need to make chips so we're not invaded. That tends to put an effort on the research end of the funding. And that's what you'll see in this law. It's subsidizing research. Does that mean that the research will all be good? Well, we've all seen studies funded by the U.S. government that doesn't necessarily mean that the research was something that needed to be done, but some good research is going to be done on this subject. This is kind of the best known way for a government to be involved in building a better product. And this goes all the way back to the Royal Society of the United Kingdom, where a bunch of scientists were put together and said, hey, we're going to give you money to think about stuff. Here you go. And you can talk about waste, and a lot of the stuff they studied was really dumb, like whether or not they could make a frog turn lead into gold. But if you didn't know you couldn't, how do you know you can't? And that's kind of the point. There's a lot of stuff like that that happened. But at the same time, the fact that you have the ability to calculate seconds in a watch was funded by this. And that's helped a lot of things. So there's a lot that comes from research funding.
I don't think there's any danger of an overabundance of chips at this point, very frankly. The reason I say that is the rate at which computer chips are being included in almost everything you buy, right down to clothing, is accelerating at an amazing exponential speed. Whether we like it or not, the world is going smart. The products are going smart. Used to be a telephone. I'm old enough to know when telephones used to be. That's what you heard when you dialed the telephone.
Well, you're actually older than that. You can go ahead and say what it sounded like to dial. Yes. What was the name of the operator that you asked to make the call for you?
Yes, I knew the name when I was a kid of the operator in our town. And if I wanted to find my grandmother, I would ask. I'd pick up the phone and she would say, "Number, please." And I would say, "This is Jeff. I want to find my grandma, or I want to find Mama Maddie," I would say. And she would say, she's in the hairdresser's right now getting her hair done. Would you like me to ring them? I mean, that's where we were.
So this is smart technology. We've come full circle. Now you just ask your phone to get a hold of whomever you need by just saying, "Call grandma."
And that's the ability to program the chips has exceeded the ability to make the chips. So it's kind of like the government effectively sponsored the making of automobiles. I don't know if people realize that. Yeah. When they changed the tax laws to allow businesses to pay lower taxes if they made more stuff. And it's worked in the past. Rural electrification was a government-sponsored program that helped tremendously. Telephone systems going out into the rural areas was sponsored by the government. There are some places where the government rightfully says, in order to be competitive in the real world, we need to let some industries go faster.
Yeah. So
I think it's appropriate.
On the solar panel side of things, the government said, "We will give you money back on your taxes if you buy a solar panel." Did it say if you buy an efficient solar panel, if these solar panels are getting better over the years? This is not money going to the solar panel companies, except that they can charge $10,000 more than they charged before. They don't have to research. People are going to buy it because they've got this extra money for buying it. And that's the issue with subsidies that are just based on you buy the thing, you get a subsidy. That's a very good short-term issue, but they tend to turn into long-term issues, and it really distorted our photovoltaic industry for about 25 years.
Well, it actually right now would not be a bad idea since we're not building new power plants in Texas.
Yeah.
We need more solar generation capacity because when the sun is, if you'll notice, when the electric distribution system says you should cut back on your electric usage is just when the sun is the brightest.
Right.
So solar panels on people's roofs is probably a pretty good idea.
Right. So as a short term to say, hey, our power grid needs some help, we're going to raise the subsidies right now for the next 6 months if you buy solar panels. Well, that makes sense as a short term, but that kind of subsidy, when it stays long term, stifles innovation. If you've got a subsidy that says, hey, we're going to help you with your research, and the research still belongs to you, but we're going to give you some money for that as either a grant or as a low interest rate loan, then that causes research in that specific area. That's how we've stayed ahead militarily from the rest of the world. And if you doubt that we're ahead militarily, just watch what the Russians are doing right now. And wow, they are nothing close to the quality that we have in our armed forces, in our equipment, in our discipline. And that comes from the right focused research type spending. The VA does a lot of that, and the Department of Defense does a lot of that when they sponsor directly funding to veteran owned research facilities. That's a very stimulating thing for research. Anyway, that's the big long answer to federal subsidies can be good, but they can also be bad. And it really depends on whether it looks like it's, oh, this is an easy thing. We'll just you know, everybody should use solar, so we're going to give you some money to do it. That's temporary. Do you want to go on to the next question?
Let's see.
The too Which costly one?
Oh, well, TSP.
The Thrift Savings Plan.
The Thrift Savings Plan has as one of its options an investment in the S&P 500 Index Fund, which they call C.
The C Fund.
The C Fund, as in Charlie, sea, not ocean. And in the S&P 500 Index are certain companies that are Chinese companies that basically support and supply the Chinese military. So the issue is, why are we doing that? Why are we taking federal money to apply towards the retirement of federal employees and giving it to the Chinese military? And the answer in the article in the Wall Street Journal that John, the Inquisitor, sent us is that it's too expensive to sort those out. Actually, I don't think it's too expensive. I just think it's a case of bureaucracy saying this is the way we're doing it, and it, to change anything would be too expensive. There are funds out there right now that are basically, you can purchase an index fund that excludes certain types of stock from the index. Now, somebody has to give us a definition of what is a Chinese company. Does, if 9% of the company is owned by Chinese investors, is it a Chinese company? It could be done, but it would be administratively a pain in the whatever, and Congress would have to authorize the money, and we would take years to remove the Chinese companies from the TSP. And they're doing a really good job of doing it themselves right now, because they're not allowing their companies to be audited by certified auditors from the United States.
Or any
list on the New York Stock Exchange.
Any certified auditor, European or otherwise. They don't have any certified auditors in China because they don't like doing audits there. Yeah.
Well, they like doing audits, but the government wants to do the audit.
No, we say, pardon me, but this looks like it was done in crayon. Do you mind if we take a look at it? No, we're very profitable, I assure you. But this is a picture of a dog. Yes. Okay.
Profitable dog.
Yeah. So even like Alibaba, which is one of the tops of China, is on the D-list threat list of, hey, this might disappear. And it's because they don't like us going in and checking to see if they really are profitable when they claim that they are. And so they are delisting themselves. And this, the other side of this answer is, it is costly if you think of it in terms of outright dollars, because the TSP is huge. It has a lot of money in it. And even if you're charging 0.1% more to try to figure out what companies are Chinese, that's a very expensive in terms of real dollars. And you can see a headline saying government spends too much money in trying to figure out, you follow that. The TSP is managed by State Street and BlackRock. BlackRock has some indexes that they look at already that excludes Chinese funds. But here's the issue. You said it. What is a Chinese company? If a Chinese company is just any company made that's in China, then we have to do a new law to exclude those companies. That would be sanctions on those companies. Do we really want to raise the tensions with China by putting sanctions on them and excluding them from the TSP? Well, we may say, hey, we're not going to do it to these strategic companies, the ones that are making military products for the Chinese. That's still a sanction. That's still going to affect their bottom line.
It would take an act of Congress to cause the TSP C fund to exclude Chinese companies, and we're out of time.
Yeah, and we're about out of time.
This is the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and Jake
McClure. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually give individually crafted and customized advice based on what people are trying to achieve. That's generally
and portfolio management.
And portfolio management. And that's generally for people with higher net worths, but we make exceptions occasionally. So you can contact us locally, voicemail available during the weekend, but actual real live people, no phone tree during the week at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that line toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN.
And I think it's important to note that we're an independent fiduciary firm. We don't work for a corporation. We only work for our clients.
Right. Exactly. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. There's a contact form. You can use emails, Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. There are recordings of the radio program going back years, newsletters going back decades, and you can find us wherever podcasts are given. Thank you very much for listening on a nice Saturday morning. And until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.